Okay, so what I'd like to start with tonight is just let you know the book Brace for Impact is at the printer. They've got the proofs back. They're even emailed me today and asked me where they wanted it shipped, so that was a good sign. It's still not due until November 1st or something like that, but we've been moving along. But as far as online, the book is online, generationword.com/, and then just the words, Brace for Impact. Like that. Nothing more than that. That'll take you right on the Generation Word site. Is that right, Tony? You want to check that and make sure it opens up like that? But that's where it's at. If you want to read Brace for Impact, Clint's done a great job of getting a little, everything's on there. We want to go ahead and start maybe teach the class when the books get here, and then he'll put a little video section on there where we'll be discussing each part of the book. That leads up to tonight. We're talking about, I gave you notes for Zechariah 12 and 13. I've been wanting to talk about Israel in the tribulation, in the midway point, and how they are sealed and how they, you know, all Israel will be saved, it says, in the end, what that means and how that takes place. And I don't fully understand all of the details because there's many moving parts as far as you got Gog and Magog battle. You've got the Zechariah verses we're going to be reading. You've got Armageddon. You've got Jesus coming out of Edom with, leading the 144,000. In Revelation, 144,000 meet the Lamb on Mount Zion, which I think is in Jerusalem, not in heaven somewhere. So all those things come together. There's battles. You've got the king of the north, the king of the south, the king of the east, that the Antichrist or the beast marches out against. He defeats the king of the south, has a battle with the king of the north. But is the king of the north that the Antichrist faces the same king of the north that you see in Ezekiel 37, 38, and 39 with Gog and Magog? And then we got to set the time for when the battle of Gog and Magog takes place. Is it before the rapture, kind of setting up the tribulation? Is it at the end, part of Armageddon, at the end of the 70th week? Is it the midway point that kind of causes the Antichrist to move in and fight or move into Israel after the king of the north has been defeated? Is that why he moves in? For some reason, he breaks his treaty and moves in at the halfway point into Jerusalem. Is that because that's when Gog and Magog take place? And again, there's arguments for all of these, and there's good reasons to reject them. Then some would say it's even the after Jesus has established the millennium, it's the nations coming together early in the millennium, the first weeks or months, to try and overthrow them, and God is having nothing to do with it, which again seems kind of strange, but yet it also seems to make sense. So I'm going to be reading some verses tonight out of Zechariah. And just kind of laying a foundation. At some point, we've got to bring this in for a landing. We began this in February, I think, understanding the times and talking about our culture, talking about the four generations, talking about where we are at potentially historically as a culture, but also what happens if we are running right up into the end times and no one knows for sure. But we're kind of now looking at those end times. And one advantage, and we should always do this, in fact, the Bible tells us we should always be watching. There's nothing wrong with looking at these things, saying, do these pieces fit together? Do we see it a little clearer now than we did before? But we are in Zechariah. I've got a set of notes here, beginning in chapter 12. And this clearly, Zechariah chapter 12, 13, and 14, and I say confidently this is clearly saying, but understand when I say that, I am definitely open to corrections. You know what I'm saying? I mean, this is I don't want to say, it's not a moving target, it's the Word of God, it's solid. But as things come together and as you adjust all the verses of Ezekiel and Zechariah, Revelation, and all the details, like that sliding ruler, it's like you get things lined up for the correct picture. These seem to be references to the end times. And this is talking about a time. If you remember when we were in, we read the seventh or the sixth seal last time we were here, and the sixth seal is where right before, well, the sixth seal opens and the sky disappears. It appears the sign of the Son of Man has appeared in the atmosphere. The sun is darkened, not disappears, it's just darkened. The moon is pale. The sky seems to disappear. And there seems to be the presence. In fact, then it says the nations, the kings, everyone says, hide us from him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb, which means they clearly see him and they're running and hiding. And it's time for the wrath to be poured out. He's bringing judgment. It is the beginning of the day of the Lord. And then in the very next chapter, you're going to see, as we talk about, 144,000 are marked, sealed by the Lord on earth. 12,000 from each of the 12 tribes of Israel. So some would say those are evangelists that are going to go out and lead people to Christ. That's the pre-trib explanation. But the text clearly says that it's 12,000 from each tribe, and it would appear then that they're Israelites. The very next part says that there's a great multitude standing before the throne that no one could count from every tribe, nation, language, and the elder asks John, who are these? Where do they come from? And John says, you know. And the elder says, these are those that have come out of the great tribulation. So that, in my teaching at this point, that would be the rapture of the church. They come out of the great tribulation. So when the church goes up to meet the Lord in the air, like it says in Thessalonians, the Jews are left on the earth because they've rejected the Messiah, and they've actually been in a treaty with the Antichrist for this period, first 3.5 years, and the Antichrist moves in, breaks the treaty, and they're like, well, that was the Antichrist. They're in a state of confusion, and then the sign of the Son of Man appears, the church is gone, and the Jews recognize at that point, that's our Messiah. And that's kind of where we're at here in Zechariah chapter 12. I've been wanting to read this for several weeks. And I'm going to try to go through chapter 12, 13, and 14 and just read through this. And again, I'm going to be making some comments, and I know the clock is ticking. So here we go. Zechariah chapter 12. This is the word of the Lord concerning Israel. Again, it's Old Testament. A lot of it's about Israel. The Lord who stretches out the heavens, who lays the foundations of the earth, and who forms the spirit of man within him declares. And all that is, all those descriptions of the Lord is laying the foundation that he can do. This is what he says about Israel. I laid the foundation. I stretched out the earth. I do all these things. And what I'm saying about Israel right here is going to happen just like I said. It's the word of God. He says, I'm going to make Jerusalem a cup that sends all the surrounding peoples reeling. Judah will be besieged as well as Jerusalem. So again, the focus here is on Jerusalem. And I do not think we need to get creative. Jerusalem is the city, Jerusalem, on the earth. It is not heaven. It's not figurative. It is Jerusalem. It's the city that David conquered. It's the city that the kings reigned in. It's the city that is promised that, the temple of God was built there, that God is going to make his home there. It's the city where the Messiah will rule from. It's the city where Jesus came to, where he died. It's the city that was destroyed in 70 AD according to Jesus' prophecy. And it is the city that is promised will be restored. And so when we talk about Jerusalem, this is interesting because this is not completely obscure. This is not like some, you get into some crazy teachings of cults or something like that. They've got some random place on the world or in the earth that no one knows of, and it's not even the news, and it's never been in, and it never is going to be. Where Jerusalem was in the news in David's day, it was in the news in Nebuchadnezzar's day, it was conquered by Nebuchadnezzar, and Cyrus helped rebuild the temple there. Alexander visited there. The Romans came in 63 and began to rule and have dominion there in Jerusalem, and overseeing the leadership of Jerusalem. And it's continued all the way up, being destroyed in 70 AD, and it's been a focus ever since 70 AD at some point. Constantine went over there, built a church at the Holy Sepulchre and many other holy sites in 325, 350 AD. It's been the center of history in many cases. In fact, some would say three religions come from there: Islam, Christian and Jewish religions. In fact, the Temple Mount has got that activity on there. On the Temple Mount on any given day, depending on what the political climate is, you're going to have Muslims, Jews, and Christians on the Temple Mount because that is something big about their religion. And we could talk about all that. So nonetheless, I mean, that covers, if you take Jews, Christians, and Muslims, that's a good portion of humanity that's looking at Jerusalem as something about the heart or center of their religion. And so it's just interesting that here in Zechariah, in around 500 BC, Jerusalem today is still in the news. And I think you can continue to expect to see Jerusalem the focus of the news as things continue. But he says in verse 2, I am going to make Jerusalem a cup that sends all the surrounding peoples reeling. Now, again, the surrounding peoples would be the nations around, and it's going to cause them to go, you know, stumbling and off balance. Judah will be besieged as well as Jerusalem. Now, when we say Judah, we're talking about the southern kingdom. We're talking about the hill country. We're talking about outside the city, the rural area, and then Jerusalem is the city, the center of Judah. Judah will be besieged as well as Jerusalem. So we're talking about Judah and Jerusalem. On that day, whenever it says on that day, we're talking about an eschatological day. On that day when these things come to pass, when all the nations of the earth are gathered against her, I will make Jerusalem an immovable rock for all the nations. So at some point, we're talking here about all the nations coming against Jerusalem. But when they come against Jerusalem, it's going to be immovable. They're not going to be able to do what they want to do with it. Now, remember, Daniel talked about it. Jesus referred to it. Starting the days of Nebuchadnezzar the Babylonian, say 605, that began the days of the Gentiles, where the Gentiles would have dominion over Jerusalem. They would trample on the temple court. They'd destroy the temple. And they went from the Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians to the Persians, to the Greeks, the Romans. Then eventually the Romans became the Byzantine Empire, the Christian form of the Roman Empire. The Byzantine Empire was conquered by the Muslims, who at this time still control the Temple Mount. So from 605 BC, the Jews have had a time to get on the Temple Mount, but in every case, it's been under the authority of a Gentile. If it be Nebuchadnezzar, sure, Cyrus sent them back to rebuild the temple, but he paid for it, and they were part of the Persian Empire. The Persian Empire fell to the Greeks. Alexander himself stopped by and worshiped in the Gentile courts in Jerusalem, but they fell under the Greek control. Then, of course, the Romans come, and then the Byzantines it becomes a Christian empire, and becomes the Byzantine Roman Empire. And then, of course, the Muslims come, and they decided that they're going to build the Dome of the Rock right on where the temple used to stand. That's an interesting debate, but there's really no doubt, even in their older writings, they did that. They actually admit that, and they say, oh, no, it's not. But it is for a variety of reasons. And that's the way it is today. It's 2021, and the Dome of the Rock is still there. The Muslims are still on the temple court, still trampling on it. I mean, the couple times I've been there several times, but there's little boys playing soccer. I mean, there's a soccer game on the Temple Mount. They're kicking a ball back and forth playing soccer. They have prayer meetings. The Muslims have prayer meetings, but the Jews are not allowed to pray. So there's a lot of going on there, but it's overrun. There's tourists there. I'm up there taking pictures. And so the Gentiles, and it's going to continue until the Lord is ready to restore that. So in this day, this city is going to become an immovable rock. And all the nations will gather. So there's a little sign right there. All the nations will come against this, and it won't move. I will make Jerusalem an immovable rock. All who try to move it will injure themselves. And again, in the notes I've got written down there that, you know, when to try to move this immovable rock, you think of someone, you know, having a hernia or something. But the word actually means, you know, cutting themselves or gashing. There it is about two-thirds of the way down. The word means to cut, gash, or lacerate deeply. It doesn't refer to hernia. That just, you know, that's your kind of way you'd think about moving an immovable rock. On that day, he says, I will strike every horse with panic and its rider with madness, declares the Lord. I will keep, now again, that sounds like Ezekiel 38 and 39, Gog and Magog, where they're laid waste in the mountains of Israel. Again, we'll try to refer to that again later, but keep that in mind. On that day, I'll strike every horse with panic and its rider with madness, declares the Lord. I'll keep a watchful eye over the house of Judah, but I will blind all the horses of the nations. Then the leaders of Judah will say in their hearts, the people of Jerusalem are strong because the Lord Almighty is their God. So they'll see a difference on that day between the nations getting confused, but the people of Judah and the Israelites rising up because they can see clearly because the Lord is making them strong, and they'll recognize that. Is that, again, a parallel with Ezekiel 38:39? On that day, I'll make the leaders of Judah like a fire pot in a wood pile. Now, notice this. This is the Lord empowering his people to do battle on this day. Now, again, this has not happened yet. These verses, again, you could go back and try, is it the Maccabean Revolt? Is it this? Is it the days of the Romans? It's like none of those. These days I'm teaching have not yet occurred. Again, you don't have to agree with that, but that's the way I'm looking at this. Judah, the people of Judah, the leaders, will be like a fire pot in a wood pile, like a flaming torch among the sheaves. In other words, nothing can stop them. They're just tearing things apart. They'll consume right and left all the surrounding peoples, and that would be the surrounding nations. If it's Old Testament, it's Ammon and Edom and Moab, Tyre, it'd be the Philistines. Well, just who's in those areas today? It'd be Syria and the Gaza Strip. It'd be Jordan. Those would be the surrounding peoples. The Lord will save the dwellings of Judah first. Now, the dwellings of Judah first, that would be the hill country, the country, not Jerusalem. It's the rural area. He'll save that first so that the honor of the house of David and of Jerusalem's inhabitants may not be greater than that of Judah. In other words, no one's going to have to be able to say it was David's family or it was the people of the city of Jerusalem. It was the strong towers or whatever military force they've got. Delivered the land, because he says, I'll make the rural residents as glorious in battle as the line of David or the people of Jerusalem. So, in other words, it's going to be a community victory, and it's going to be very clear that no individual stood up and won this war. On that day, the Lord will shield those who live in Jerusalem. Shield. How will the Lord shield them? We see constant bombing going back and forth, the Gaza Strip and even Lebanon and Syria sending things down, and vice versa, Israel retaliating. Is this shield something that we'd be familiar with today, like the Iron Shield or something? I mean, it's just hanging right there. You have to at least mention it. Is God going to use something like that, or is he going to do it supernaturally? On that day, the Lord will shield those who live in Jerusalem so that the feeblest among them will be like David, and the house of David will be like God. Now, you got to wonder, the house of David is being mentioned here. It's like, do we know who the house of David is today? Could you point out these are the family of David in Jerusalem today? Can you do that yet? But anyway, the average person will be like David, and the house of David will be like God, and the angel of the Lord going before them. On that day, I will set out to destroy all the nations that attack Jerusalem. So if they're attacking Jerusalem this day, that is the day God is going out to destroy the nations. Is that the second coming when he's going out to destroy the nations? Is that Gog and Magog? Again, but that's his purpose. Watch this. Verse 10. Now, that is talking about a physical deliverance. And what you're going to see here is a parallel with coming out of Egypt. There was a physical deliverance out of Egypt, and then he got them in the wilderness and tried to bring about some spiritual deliverance, some deliverance for their soul. And they floundered at 40 years of wasted time. We're going to see a different thing here, but we see the same pattern. There was their physical deliverance, and now that they've been physically delivered from the nations, now he's going to save them spiritually. And here is when Paul says all Israel will be saved. This is part of that concept here. In verse 10, and I will pour out on the house of David and the inhabitants of Jerusalem a spirit of grace and supplication. A grace is the free gift of grace, an offer, and then the response, whether he's going to offer them and then cause the response. They will look to or look on me, the one they have pierced. Now, That was used in the book of John when Jesus was on the cross and not one of his bones were broken. They quote Psalm and they quote this verse. They says, just according to the scriptures, not one of his bones was broken, and we looked on the one we pierced. So John saw this as a reference to the one on the cross. Now, that wasn't necessarily the fulfillment of that, because this is in the midst of a battle. This is in the midst of some day in the future where the whole nation is going to see that. But clearly, when it says the one they pierced, the New Testament knew that was Jesus Christ. So they will have a spirit of grace and supplication poured out. They'll look on me, the one they have pierced. Now, this is why I say when the sign of the Son of Man appears and the rapture of the church takes place, they meet him there. And the world says, hide us from him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. The Jews themselves will see the Lamb, and the Lamb is not a lamb. The Lamb is Jesus, who is their Messiah, the one they pierced. And when they see the one they pierced, and they will mourn for him as one mourns for an only child, and grieve bitterly for him as one grieves for a firstborn son. In other words, if we put this, and again, if I say it this way, he appears to pour out wrath on the world to deliver the church, the rapture of the church, but there's the Jews now seeing, oh my gosh, that's our Messiah. And they, what we would say in Christian terms, they get saved, or they are renewed. They are born again. They accept Christ as the Messiah. And now they are believers, but they are now not part of the church, because the church got raptured. They're believers, but now we're into the final days. There you've got your distinction between the church and Israel and faith. You can't, if you go with this, again, you can do it. People do it all the time in their teaching on pre-trib. But if the church is raptured on pre-trib to separate the Jews from the church, and then the Jews then return, well, they really aren't returning. They're signing a contract or a treaty with the Antichrist for 3.5 years while the Antichrist is slaughtering believers. So it's hardly, you know, the separation of the church and Israel. Now, they're still with the world. It is at this point they separate from the world because the church has been raptured. God is coming in wrath, or the Lord is there to pour out his wrath, but Israel accepts Christ at this point. And I think we can see, well, now again, if this is the case, we'll see this also in Revelation. But nonetheless, it says, on that day, the weeping in Jerusalem will be great, like the weeping of Hadad Rimmon on the plain of Megiddo, and that's when Josiah died. The land will mourn, each clan for itself with their wives by themselves, the clan of the house of David and their wives, the clan of the house of Nathan and their wives, the clan of the house of Levi and their wives, and the clan of Shimei and their wives, and the rest of the clans and their wives. And what you name is David and that family. Then you take a step down to someone lower than David in the line of Judah. Then you go over to the Levite tribe and name that tribe. Then you step down into someone lower in that. In other words, what they're saying is from the highest all the way down through the ranks of the families and tribes, they're getting saved. They're getting born again. I think this is when Paul says all Israel will be saved. It's because they saw the Messiah when he comes back. And that's what that is saying. They're just listing off layers of people groups. Verse 13, on that day, again, we got a new chapter, but don't let it interfere right here with the flow. On that day, again, an eschatological reference to this event. On that day, a fountain will be opened to the house of David and its inhabitants of Jerusalem to cleanse them from sin and impurity. So the pour of grace and supplication came. They respond to it. Well, now here is the washing away of their sin. On that day, I will banish the names of the idols from the land, and they will be remembered no more, declares the Lord Almighty. I'll remove both the prophets and the spirit of impurity from the land. And if anyone prophesies and talks here about prophets and people that are trying to bring about revelation, in other words, all that is closed, and they now have the Messiah, and they've moved on. Verse 7, awake, O shepherd, against awake, O sword, against my shepherd. Now, this is an interesting set of verses. This is going to be talking about 30 AD and 70 AD. In 30 AD, that's where the sword strikes Jesus. Against the man who is close to me, declares the Lord Almighty, strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered, and I will return my hand against the little ones. Now, what takes place there is in 30 AD, the shepherd was struck by the sword, And the result of that was in 30 AD. And by 70 AD, the sheep, the people of Israel, were scattered. So they've been scattered since 70 AD until this event in that day. So that he sent his Messiah, the sword struck him, or he was pierced, he was crucified. And because of that, they had no leadership, and they went into rebellion against the Roman Empire, and then they were destroyed, and they've been scattered since 70 AD. Again, I'm rushing through these things. Strike the shepherd, and the sheep will be scattered, and I will turn my hand against the little ones. And that is what he's saying. I have turned my hand against Israel, the people of Israel, since 70 AD. Now watch this. In the whole land, declares the Lord, two-thirds will be struck down and perish, yet one-third will be left. So that's just the math he's saying. Now, what that refers to, two-thirds perish of the sheep that were scattered, the little ones, one-third are going to be preserved. Now, is that throughout history? Is that going to be, you got the Holocaust, you could try to put the Jews were attempted to destroy this? Or are we talking about at this point in history, on that day when they're brought back, there's the Antichrist will end up destroying two-thirds, but through this time, there'll be one-third will be spared. Just like the Antichrist will be striking down believers, slaughtering believers, as we see earlier in the tribulation, will two-thirds be eliminated, but one-third will be preserved? Well, clearly he says one-third. Could this one-third be a reference to the 144,000 that are sealed in Revelation chapter 7 that are then protected until the end? I don't know. I'm just looking for parallels here or making suggestions. Clearly, you've got to explain the whole land, two-thirds will be struck down and perish, yet one-third will be left in it. This third, what is he going to do with this one-third? I will bring into the fire. I will refine them like silver and test them like gold. They will call on my name and I will answer them. I will say, they are my people, and they will say, the Lord is our God. Now, I have no trouble saying that appears to be a direct correlation of what will take place in the tribulation during the 70th week, the 7 years. During that first half, you got your seven years here. During the first half, they're going to have peace and harmony with the Antichrist. They're on the Temple Mount worshiping, but they think they found their Messiah, but it's not. At the halfway point, he breaks the treaty, and Jesus even says, when that happens, don't look back. Get to the mountains. If you're in the field, go to the mountains. If you're in the city, go to the mountains. Don't go back in the house and get your coat. Don't run into the city and just start running. And because the Antichrist is going to start slaughtering the Jews as he comes into Jerusalem. That could be where two-thirds are destroyed. Soon after that, the sign of the Son of Man appears. The church is raptured to meet the Lord in the air. And 144,000 are sealed, 12,000 from each of the tribes of Israel. So, and they then are taken and protected until the end of the tribulation. Or during this last period right here, they are protected. And they end up fighting alongside God. They fight along with God. So again, that is kind of would kind of make sense. And again, you can see that they're being tested, just like they're tested in the wilderness. They're being tested here and being brought into the faith. And again, it's going to be successful. So you've got your physical deliverance, and then you've got your spiritual deliverance. Chapter 14. A day of the Lord is coming when your plunder will be divided among you. Now, we've talked about a victory here in chapter 12, how the tribe of Judah is and David is like burning sheaths and just, fire pots. Well, now, this is a day of the Lord is coming when your plunder will be divided against you. Now, is this the same situation? Is this, going to be the earlier battle that's going to result in the great victory in the end? But it sounds like a battle right here towards the end. In fact, I think this is part of what we'd say the battles of Armageddon or the Armageddon campaign. This would be part one of the battles that you have here. again, Armageddon, not necessarily one particular day of battle, but a series of events, because you've got things taking place in Edom. You've got things taking place in the Jezreel Valley. You've got things taking place in the Valley of Jehoshaphat outside of Jerusalem in the Kidron Valley. And then you've got these things taking place. And so it's like, it's not just one battle. It's an event. It's a campaign potentially. So here we go. In that day, I'll just read what it says here. A day of the Lord is coming. Now, how does this fit into this sequence? When your plunder will be divided among you. In other words, there's a day coming where Jerusalem is going to be overrun. Your plunder is going to be divided. But when that begins to happen, it's not going to be finished. You're going to be invaded. And I don't think this is the same thing as chapter 38 and 39 of Ezekiel, the Gog and Magog, because that battle never gets off the ground. And the Jews don't actually fight that battle. They just stand back and watch the Lord bring about a deliverance. Kind of like parting of the Red Sea. They didn't help swim across the Red Sea. They just stood and watched. Where with Gideon, they actually fought. Or with David, they actually fought. Anyway, the plunder will be divided in Jerusalem on this particular day, probably an eschatological event yet in the future. I will gather all the nations to Jerusalem to fight against it. God is on purpose. He says in Revelation, he sends out demons to gather the nations for battle. He uses demonic forces to lure the kings together for battle so he can destroy them. And here he says, I will gather all nations to Jerusalem. Exactly what Revelation says. But here's what takes place. The city will be captured. Again, that's not Ezekiel 38 and 39. And this is not 70 AD or 586. 586 BC already is history in the time of Zechariah. So he's not talking about something that's already happened. The city will be captured, the houses ransacked, and the women raped. Half the city will go into exile, but the rest of the people will not be taken from the city. Something happens. The city is being overrun. People are lined up to go into exile. It says, then the Lord will go out and fight against those nations as he fights in the day of battle. On that day, his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives. So now, this is what I would traditionally call the second coming, where Jesus is in heaven watching these things take place. We even know that in Revelation when the fifth seal, the martyrs under the altar in heaven, how much longer are you going to wait? He says, a little longer until the full number has come in, being martyred like you have, and he's just waiting. Well, here he's had enough, and he goes out and engages in battle, and his feet stand on the Mount of Olives. Now, this is lined up with what the angels said to the disciples, that Jesus ascended into the clouds. The same Jesus you saw is going to come back the same way he left. He physically ascended, and he's going to come back the same way. He stood on the Mount of Olives and ascended. He's going to come back and land on the Mount of Olives. So this, again, is part of that Armageddon series, because you've got him appearing in Edom. You've got him appearing in the Jezreel Valley. You've got him making judgment in the Valley of Jehoshaphat. And now he's coming back in full force on the Mount of Olives, as Jerusalem is being laid waste, people are being taken captive, and Jesus comes back, and his feet stand on the Mount of Olives. So this is, in a sense, the second coming. Now, understand, I have no trouble with having Jesus, again, and you can question me on this, and you should, because we want the truth. I have no trouble with the sign of the Son of Man appearing in the atmosphere at the sixth seal. And the world can see that, and they run and hide. Hide is from him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. And they run and hide. And he's there for a period of time. Weeks, months, 18 months, a year and a half. I don't know. But he's there. The Jews have a time to recognize it and repent. He seals them. The world, the nations, apparently, as they're running and hiding from the wrath of the Lamb, they have time to regroup, to come out and attack Jerusalem. Right here. So he would have been not in heaven, but in our atmosphere. This is the way I'm presenting it. The sign of the Son of Man appeared. It doesn't just appear like lightning and come down, but it appears like lightning. Everyone sees it, but then it's like vultures circling. You know, wherever the dead body is, the vultures gather. That's Jesus. He is the vultures circling, and it's a period of time as he's just watching. Now, as the nations regroup, he's pouring his wrath out. We got the trumpets coming. And then they invade Jerusalem, and it looks like they're winning. And at a certain point, he goes out and fights. He leaves heaven. He leaves his throne, you know, from that the platform that he's in, like Ezekiel saw the sign of Son of Man. He saw the Son of Man saw that and comes down and fights like he does on the day of battle. He engages the world in battle. Does that make sense? You see, you understand what I'm saying? I mean, that gives you room. Otherwise, if you just have just a bolt of lightning, there's the second coming. It's like it's a moment. And that's fine. That could be correct. But if you have him appearing, you've got time to have him pouring out the trumpets, and you got the bowls, and you've got him interacting and the people responding to his presence there. And you've got to explain why when he first appears, they all run and hide. But by the time this day gets here, they've regrouped and they're actually overrunning Jerusalem. I mean, how the nations all gather together? Clearly, they can see the Lord, but they're willing to fight against him. And he's giving them room. How would you say it? He's giving them enough rope to hang themselves. It's like, here I am. You're going to still fight me? Are you going to repent? It's like, no, we're going to organize our worldly armies to fight you. It's like, well, good luck. I know it worked in the Armageddon movies on television where, you know, Will Smith can win the day, but it's like, it ain't going to happen here. Then the Lord will go out, and I'm in verse 3 of chapter 14. Then the Lord will go out and fight against those nations as he fights in the day of battle. On that day, his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives east of Jerusalem. And the Mount of Olives will be split in two from east to west. So it's going to open up, forming a great valley with half the mountain moving north and half the mountain moving south. You will flee by my mountain valley, for it will extend to Azel. Now, Azel or Azel is a plain south. And so the mountain's going to move east to west, forming a great valley. And the people of Jerusalem that are being taken as exiles or in the midst of battle, they'll be able to just run. It'd be an escape route. Now, when I don't have a picture up time, I never have the right pictures up. But when the Jews escaped in 70 AD, where they tried to escape, they would get into one of the roads that goes down to the Pool of Siloam, and they'd get in the gutter, and they'd go down through the gutter out of the city where the water runs, and they'd try to escape. And that's been excavated. I got a chance to walk in it the very same year. They just found it, and I got a chance to walk through it and videotaped it. And so, but you can still see the pavement stones up atop, and they'd run down that gutter and get out of the city, some of them. Josephus even records the Romans knew they're hiding and that it was like rats packed in the sewer underneath, that they'd break the stones and peel the stones off and then just slaughter the Jews that were trapped in the gutter underneath there and just left their dead bodies there. Well, that's the same idea here, is there's going to be when Jesus lands, the Mountain of Olives is going to move to the east and to the west, forming a valley, and the people will be able to go right out of the city and run down that valley and escape the invasion of the nations while he lays them waste. That's what's being said right there. Then the Lord my God will come and all the holy ones with him. Now again, this is the second coming, I think. My Lord will come and the holy ones with him. And the holy ones could be angels, which it refers to angels coming back with him, or it could be the resurrected saints coming back, and that we see that also. So when it says holy ones, I'm not sure if it's referring to angels or saints. It could be referring to both. If it's a time of war, you'd think it'd be angels, but we also see the church returning victorious, fighting with Jesus, along with the Jews fighting. On that day, there'll be no light, no cold or frost. It will be a unique day without daytime or nighttime, a day known to the Lord. When evening comes, there will still be light, which is reminiscent of the day that Joshua had the sun stand still. In other words, the Lord is going to go out and fight. Oh, the sun is going down. No, it's not. Freeze. Everything stops. Time, in a sense, stops, or at least the solar system stops, and he's allowed to finish this battle. It will be a unique day. Don't expect to see this again. This is not like the way the millennium's going to be. This was a unique day where the Lord just stopped time or stopped the sun to finish his battle. Again, reflecting back to the days of Gideon. On that day, living water will flow out from Jerusalem, half to the eastern sea. That would be the Dead Sea, and half to the Western Sea. That's the Mediterranean Sea in summer and in winter. Now, as a result of that mountain being, or the Mount of Olives being moved and that valley being formed, water is going to begin to flow. And you can read about this. This is also mentioned in Ezekiel. It's going to actually flow out of Mount Moriah, where there's water. The Gihon Springs is just to the south of that, and there's water systems in there. But it's going to flow, and as it comes up, it's going to flow both directions. And in fact, it's going to connect the Mediterranean Sea with the Dead Sea, and it's going to be fresh water flowing into the Dead Sea. And if you know, the Dead Sea is the lowest place on Earth, and so the water that goes there, it just stops and evaporates, leaving behind all the minerals year after year after year. So it's like, what is it, 7 times saltier than the ocean or something like this, if you've ever been there, and I have a couple times. You float. I mean, you don't want to put your head in the water, because it really, if you put your head in the water, you go to the hospital, because you can't let anything get in your, because it would go into your ears, it would go into your sinuses, and you'd have to have your head cleaned out. They tell you, when you get in, do not let your head get in the water. Do not let it get in your eyes. Don't put your head underwater and try and swim. You will go blind. I mean, this is, so when you get out there, it's kind of like, oh, this is fun, I'm floating. It's like, and I, you know, even when we were doing it, a couple things happened. I mean, I remember you're swimming, and I was laying on my, just floating, reading the newspaper, looking cool. I had Tony take a picture, you know. But, you know, at some point you got a little splash of salt in your eye, and it's like, oh, Tony, you know, I want to tell him what you did one time in 2007. What did you do that the night before? Shaved your legs. And then the next day morning she gets down to the, she's like, oh, and her legs were, you know, and I've never shaved my legs, so I don't know what that would mean, but it's like, but anyway, that's how salty it is. Nonetheless, the water's going to flow into the Eastern Sea, the Dead Sea, but it's going to be fresh water. It's going to fill up, and it's going to continue to flow out towards the, it's going to make a ravine or a wadi down to the Gulf of Aqaba, connecting the Red Sea with the Dead Sea, with Jerusalem, which is now a seaport, with the Mediterranean Sea. And in Ezekiel, you can read about the same situation. That's where Ezekiel walks out. It's ankle deep, it's knee deep, it's waist deep. Pretty soon, it's a river that he can swim in. And he goes down to the Dead Sea, and there's fishermen casting nets into the Dead Sea, because now it's freshwater. It says the same kind of fish that are in the Western Sea will be in the Dead Sea. Now, that's in Ezekiel. So I think we're clearly talking about the end right here of the 70th week when the Lord returns, and he's preparing Jerusalem to be the center of the world economics, the world government of his empire. Isaiah says Jerusalem will be lifted up. High, be the highest mountain of all the mountains. And the idea there is, if it's figurative, it means it's going to be the center of all the governments. But if it's literal, which we see here in other places because of the topography changes, some parts of the land are going to go flat, but Jerusalem is going to be lifted up, raised up. It's going to be a high mountain fortress where the king, Jesus, is going to rule and reign from, and it's going to be a seaport city with water running out of it. So there's going to be some topography changes at that place. That's all being mentioned right here. Verse 8 again, chapter 14, verse 8. On that day, living water will flow out from Jerusalem, half to the Eastern Sea and half to the Western Sea in the summer and in winter. The Lord will be king over the whole earth. So this is clearly the millennial kingdom. Or has just, on that day, there will be one Lord and his name, the only name. Now again, he's going to be king over the whole earth, but that still leaves room for kings and rulers that are under him, because there will still be nations. We saw that in other places. There's still going to be nations in the world with kings and governments, but they'll all be answering and responding to the Lord. The whole land from Geba, that's in the north, to Rimmon in the south, south of Jerusalem, will become like the Araba, meaning it goes flat. The Araba is a flat level. So this topography change includes a collapsing of the land as Jerusalem is raised up. But Jerusalem will be raised up and remain in its place from the Benjamin gate to the site of the first gate to the corner gate. Again, the Benjamin gate is on the north side, the mountain gate, the first gate, the corner gate is on the west, and from the Tower of Hanel, that's on the west wall, to the royal wine that's on the south of the city, the wine press. That's where the palace would have been. It will be inhabited, never again to be destroyed. Jerusalem will be secure. Now, verse 12. This is the plague with which the Lord will strike all the nations that fought against Jerusalem on that time right there. When he goes out and his feet strike the land on the Mount of Olives. Their flesh will rot while they are still standing on their feet. Their eyes will rot in their sockets, and their tongues will rot in their mouths. On that day, men will be stricken by the Lord, that's the word Yahweh, with great panic. Each man will seize the hand of another, and they will attack each other. The nations won't know who's on whose side. Judah too will fight. Here it is. Judah too will fight at Jerusalem. See right here? That's where you're talking again. You got the people of those 144,000 that came with the Lord. They're in the city and they're fighting alongside of him. Judah too will fight at Jerusalem. The wealth of all the surrounding nations will be collected. Great quantities of gold and silver and clothing. A similar plague will strike the horses and mules, the camels and donkeys, and all the animals in those camps. Verse 16, then the survivors from all the nations that have attacked Jerusalem will go up year after year to worship the king. Now watch what's happening right here. Now it goes that there's more details going to take place. It's not just then that afternoon, everything's fine. We can read Revelation. There's other events that the world has to be reset. Different things will take place. But ultimately, not every nation is laid waste. Who rots? Whose flesh rots? It's the military that is attacking Jerusalem. They are destroyed. But they are sent there by different countries. All the nations sent their people, their military. The militaries are destroyed. But back in the homelands, there are still people. They're the survivors. They're like, uh-oh. And now they're going to have a choice. Now you're going to have the sheep and goat judgment where the believers are welcomed into the kingdom. The unbelievers are sent away. But the believers that are sent back to their home nations to establish governments and societies under the lordship of Jesus Christ, who's like an emperor, if you would, over the whole world. Each year, it says right here, verse 16, they're going to come up and worship in Jerusalem. It will be a requirement that you participate in some kind of annual celebration. It appears to be the Feast of Tabernacles, which is often considered today when they talk about the Feast of Booths, remembering when they lived in little shelters in the wilderness. But that was also remnants or trying to remember or anticipate, just like the Lord dwelling with Israel in the wilderness in the tabernacle, he will now be abiding with them, living with them in Jerusalem. So this is one of those feasts that can look back and remember when they were in the wilderness, living in tents with the presence of the Lord. But there's a day coming where the Lord's presence will actually be here and we'll be living with the presence of the Lord. So the yearly, you talk about Christmas being a celebration of the Lord's coming. We remember when the Lord came. This will be a yearly celebration that the Lord is dwelling on earth with us. And the nations will go yearly to worship and celebrate the fact the Lord is back, that he is the one that controls the government, that controls the economy, controls the environment. Again, not in the sense that he's just magically doing everything, but he's ruling it, like it says, with an iron scepter. You're doing it his way or no way at all. So that's what it says right here. Then the survivors, verse 16, from all the nations that attacked Jerusalem will go up year after year to worship the King, the Lord Almighty, and to celebrate, here it is, the Feast of Tabernacles, which recalls the fact the Lord dwelt with them in the wilderness, but someday he will dwell with them permanently. And now they're celebrating Christmas. I mean, actually, like it's Christmas. I mean, they're celebrating the Feast of Tabernacles because it's Tabernacles. He's here. This is interesting. This sets the stage for the end of the millennium. If any of the people of the earth do not go up to Jerusalem to worship the King, the Lord Almighty, they will have no reign. Now, again, I don't know the logistics of this. If everybody in the world has to get on planes and fly to Jerusalem and be standing in the courts of the temple every year, or you've got to send representatives from every country. Do you understand? I don't know the logistics. I mean, you're going to want to go, but I mean, to have everybody there, you know, I don't know. But every nation has to at least, I would assume, at the minimum, have brought their gifts. Maybe they bring some, you know, they collect the taxes and they bring the gift to the king. If your nation decides, no, we're done, we're going to become our own nation, our own empire. We're going to separate from the United States of America and be our own little country. Well, you can, but remember, we control the weather. And your little state area, your little border area will have no rain that year. Good luck. In other words, that's what it says. It says, is that possible? Well, I'm sure it's possible. It's Jesus Christ. The King of the Lord Almighty, they will get no rain. Then he gives you an example. If the Egyptian people do not go up and take part, they will have no rain. The Lord will bring on them the plague he inflicts on the nations that do not go up to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles. So if you want to get rain and not have the plague, you want, you know, not to have, you know, get your COVID shots, you'll have to go worship the Lord and then you'll be fine. You'll have no plague and you'll have rain. You may go back. But if you decide we're going to rebel, well, then fine, but you're not going to get anything from me. This will be the punishment of Egypt and the punishment of all the nations that do not go up to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles. On that day, holy to the Lord will be inscribed on the bells of horses. Now, what it's saying here, in the Old Testament, there were certain utensils that were holy to the Lord. For example, the gold goblets that were taken from the temple and Belshazzar drank, those were holy to the Lord. Or things the priest used, those were holy to the Lord. You'd have your secular items that you'd use in your homes or maybe use in the outer courts of the temple. But then you'd have the ones that were holy to the Lord that were just dedicated to the Lord. In this day, in the millennium, or with the days that they're celebrating the Feast of Tabernacles, everything is holy to the Lord. There's no separation between clean or unclean, secular or holy. Even the horses, if you put bells on horses, they have to be stamped, not made in China, but this is holy to the Lord. What about is this book? Oh man, holy to the Lord. It's like everything. It's like this marker. It's like made in. It's like, yep, yeah, right there. Part of the kingdom. Holy to the Lord. It's like this eraser. It's like stamped holy to the Lord. It's like, I mean, you can't get everything we buy by comes from China. Well, everything in those days, everything there will be already stamped. This belongs to the Lord. It's holy to the Lord. Use this for the Lord's glory. Is there anything secular? Mm-mm. Nope. Everything's part of the knowledge of the Lord will fill the earth. I mean, that's what's being said right there. Even the bells of the horses will be marked holy to the Lord. And the cooking pots in the Lord's house will be like the sacred bowls in front of the altar. Every pot in Jerusalem and Judah will be holy to the Lord Almighty. And all who come to sacrifice will take some of the pots and cook in them. And on that day, there'll no longer be a Canaanite in the house of the Lord Almighty. And a Canaanite, that may be a reference. People usually say that refers to a merchant, someone there who is making money selling stuff. It's like, no, everything here is for the Lord's use. And that is how the book of Zechariah ends. And that, again, there's a lot of things we're looking at there speculating on. But the idea that we're looking at there was the Jews, Judah, Jerusalem, being ready for battle during that 70th week. Now, I want to, what time is it? Okay, we've got time possibly to look at a couple verses in Revelation. The first 3.5 years, the Jews are going to have peace. They're worshiping in the temple. At the halfway point, this is where the Antichrist comes in, says he is God, sets himself up in the temple. Israel is scattered. They don't know what's going on. It's like, what is happening? The sign of the Son of Man appears right here, and that is where the church meets him in the air. And Israel recognizes that's our Messiah, the one we pierced. They mourn for him, and they are saved. And they're marked, 144,000 are marked, 144,000 are sealed. And they will be protected, and then they'll reemerge here. And I'm going to show you those verses. They'll emerge on this day. And again, all the details, the Lord will pour out the judgments, the wrath. And then right here, his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives. Now, I gave you a lot of notes I never even used, but go to the back page, page 6, and you know these verses. I want to just read through them. Revelation 7. In Revelation 7, this is right after the sixth seal was opened. Revelation 6, verse 12. The great earthquake, the moon turned black, the stars fell from the sky, receded. And then all the kings of the earth says, hide us from him who sits on the throne from the wrath of the Lamb. And then they ask, and who can stand? And who can stand with him? And who can stand outside in front of his wrath? Well, chapter 7, verse 1 gives you two groups. The first group is chapter 7, verse 1. After this, I saw the four angels standing at the four corners of the earth, holding back the four winds of the earth to prevent any wind from blowing on the land or on the sea or on the tree. Then I saw another angel coming up from the east, having the seal of the living God. He called out in a loud voice to the four angels who had been given power not to harm the land or the sea. Do not harm the land or the sea, meaning we're getting ready to harm the land and the sea with the wrath of God. Don't start yet. Do not start, do not harm the land or the sea or the trees until we put a seal on the foreheads of the servants of our God. Then I heard the number of those who were sealed, 144,000 from all the tribes of Israel. Again, you've got that number, 144,000 from all the tribes. Then it tells you again, a second time, 12,000 from Judah, 12,000 from Reuben, 12,000 from Gad. And there you've got 144,000 Jews that are sealed at this point right here. The Antichrist is ruling and reigning. Now they're protected. The church is gone. And I mean, I got to go with these are Jews because it says these are going to be from the tribes of Israel, 144,000, and then it names them as the tribes. So that's Israel being sealed. Now in verse 9, so those people are going to be able to stand on the earth during these days. Who can stand? Well, these guys, they've got the seal. The other group that can stand are those that were taken up, and that's in chapter 7, verse 9. After this I looked, and there before me was a great multitude that no one could count from every nation, tribe, people, language, standing before the throne. And then they're asked, who are these? Where do they come from? They are those that have come out of the great tribulation. I think that's the raptured church standing there with the other martyred saints. Okay, now, the next verse, I just want to show you this, chapter 12. Again, this is treacherous to read this chapter here. Chapter 12, a great and wondrous sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and a crown of 12 stars on her head. She was pregnant and cried out in pain. She was about to give birth. Then another sign appeared in heaven, an enormous red dragon. So the first sign is a woman. Basically, it appears to be, you can say that's Israel. Or basically what it is, it seems to be the promises of God of salvation coming through Israel. You got the 12 stars or the 12 stars on the crown. And then you've got an enormous red dragon, which would be the opposition. That would be Satan with seven heads. Those are the seven major empires, starting with Babylon, Persia, Greece, all the way down to the final kingdom of the Antichrist. And 10 horns and 7 crowns. And those 10 horns would be the last 10 rulers. If we read the rest of the book of Revelation, Daniel, and one of those is the Antichrist. His tail swept a third of the stars out of the sky and flung them to the earth. Now that's the verse, like I've said before, that's where you get a third of the angels fell when Satan fell. I'm not saying that's not right, but that's your verse. How many angels went with Satan? A third. So it appears he swept a third of the stars. Now, that seems to be like in ancient history, maybe even before mankind that took place. But nonetheless, that's Satan and his cohorts that are coming against the woman, which is the promises of God kept with Israel. The dragon stood in front of the woman who's about to give birth so that he might devour her child the moment it was born. Again, that would be Satan trying to, from the very beginning, waiting for the son, seed of the woman to be born. If it be, you know, Cain or Abel or Noah or Isaac or David or whoever it was, he wasn't going to let them have their power or get his power. She gave birth to a son, a male child, who will rule all the nations with an iron scepter. Now, that goes right back to Jacob's prophecy in Genesis 50. Jesus will rule with an iron scepter. And her child was snatched up to God and to his throne. Jesus ascended. The woman fled into the desert. Now, that would be Israel. Now, the woman is clearly Israel. I mean, I would say in this interpretation. The woman fled into a desert, to a place prepared for her by God where she might be taken care of for 1,260 days. Now, this can parallel with what's taking place in Daniel, but this whole time is 1,260 days, 42 months, 3.5 years. Now, I've kind of used, if this is the Antichrist reveals himself here, you're going to have, when's the sign of the Son of Man appears? It seems in that illustration, like almost immediately after, almost at the halfway point. So again, but anyway, the woman's going to, Israel is going to be in the wilderness for 3.5 years. Is that the 144,000? I mean, I'm saying yes. At this point, at least, making a connection. And there was war in heaven. Michael and his angel fought against the dragon. Dragon, they fought back. And it goes on and talks about that. I just want to point out that they're in the wilderness. Look in verse 13. When the dragon saw that he had been hurled to the earth, he pursued the woman, see, Satan, And that's possibly when, you know, the sign of the Son of Man appears. That's when Satan falls out of the atmosphere, because that's the sign. He's the ruler of the prince of the power of the air. He falls. That's when he sets himself up here and begins to pursue Israel. They're marked there in the wilderness. He pursues the woman who had given birth to the male child, the one that Messiah came from. The woman was given the two wings of a great eagle so that she might fly to the place prepared for her in the desert, where she would be taken care of for a time, times, and half a time. And that's 3.5 years. Out of the serpent's reach. So that's, she's protected. Out of the serpent's reach. Then from his mouth, the serpent, I don't know what this would be, but it could be a military invasion. Then from his mouth, the serpent, that would be the Antichrist possibly manifesting it, the serpent spewed water like a river to overtake the woman and sweep her away with a torrent. But the earth helped the woman by opening its mouth and swallowing the river that the dragon had spewed out of his mouth. Now, could that be Ezekiel 38 and 39, the Gog and Magog invasion, and then the earth just consumes them? Possibly. But then there's other issues. Then the dragon was enraged at the woman, Israel, and went off to make war against the rest of her offspring, who are who? Those who obey God's commandments and hold to the testimony of Jesus. And that would be believers then at this point in history. Again, the church is gone. This would be new believers that are holding to it, if you want to put it in that sequence. So that is that reference. And then Revelation 14, chapter 14, verse 1. Now, we know from Isaiah that the Lord is going to come down in Edom. Who is this coming forth from Edom? Mighty. You know, he's trampled the nations. Why is your garment stained with blood? I've trampled the nations. There's no one to help me. I did it by myself. And he's striding forth into Jerusalem or into Israel. Again, that's the second coming, but the second coming is on the Mount of Olives. But then the Battle of Armageddon, Jezreel Valley, all this. Well, here we got this one, chapter 14, verse 1. Then I looked, and there before me was the Lamb standing on Mount Zion. Now, that is in Jerusalem. That would be Mount Moriah. Now, there is a Mount Zion in Jerusalem that's called Mount Zion. It's to the west of Mount Moriah. It's actually got Mount Moriah, then you got a little bit of a valley that's pretty much been filled in. Then it rises to Mount Zion. It's kind of the western side of Jerusalem. They call it Mount Zion, but even the city is called Zion, but even Mount Moriah is called Zion. Even heaven's called Zion. So be careful, just because there's a landmarker called Zion. This would seem to be he's in Jerusalem on the Temple Mount, standing on Mount Zion, and watch this, and with him 144,000 who had his name and his father's name written on their foreheads. It's going to be hard to not make this 144,000 that was sealed at this point in chapter 7 to be the same 144,000 that had been protected in the wilderness and now are with him in Jerusalem, possibly having fought wars with him if we look at Zechariah. And I heard a sound from heaven like the roar of rushing waters and like the sound, a loud peal of thunder. The sound I heard was like that of the harpists playing their harps. Again, you can go with harps if you want to, but I mean the sound of thunder. I mean, we're talking classic rock guitar solos right here. The sound I heard was like that of the harpists playing their harps. And they sang a new song before the throne and before the four living creatures and the elders. No one could learn the song except the 144,000 who had been redeemed from the earth. These are those who did not defile themselves with women. Well, now, what does that mean? For they kept themselves pure and follow the Lamb wherever he goes. They are purchased from among men and are offered as first fruits to God and the Lamb. No lie was found on their mouths. They are blameless. Again, that's another mention of the 144,000. Just, again, you see how I presented it. Some would make this 144,000 a general large number of all the believers of all time. Maybe, you know, pre-trib, those are the 144,000 that go off as missionaries here at the beginning and convert many of the world. But there we've got it right there. I'm out of time, and that's what we're looking at right there. There's something taking place with the Jews seeing the one they pierced. We saw it in Zechariah, fighting battles with him, several battles taking place, Jesus intervening, allowing Jerusalem to be overrun, but also saying it's an immovable rock, you'll never move it, and at some point in history going out and intervening and delivering Jerusalem along with the help of Judah and the house of David, and then setting up his millennial kingdom. That's just some more information. I'll pray, and we're done. If you got any questions or comments, that would be great. Father, we do thank you again for the chance to look into these things. We thank you for your word. We ask that we would use it to lead and guide ourselves, to find a source of encouragement and strength that we may do the things you've called us to confidently at this time in history. Again, we thank you for this opportunity to study your word. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you for your patience.